Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. If you're hiring, with Indeed, you can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on your short list of qualified candidates using an online dashboard. Get started at Indeed.com/NPR podcast.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. On paper, Jose Antonio Vargas is an American success story, a young immigrant who worked hard and excelled in his California high school, who threw everything he had into a journalism career and won a Pulitzer Prize at the Washington Post, who loved his family and paid his taxes. So again, on paper, he's a success. But the thing is, Jose Antonio Vargas has no papers. He is an undocumented immigrant. No longer able to live with the lies, in 2011, he went public with his status, and later he testified before Congress.
Too often we're treated as abstractions, faceless and nameless, subjects of debate, rather than individuals with families, hopes, fears, and dreams.
In his new memoir, Vargas tells his whole story. This hour on Point, Jose Antonio Vargas's letter to America from an undocumented citizen, as he calls himself. You can join us. What does it really mean to be a citizen, to be an American? What is your question for Jose Antonio Vargas? And joining me now is Jose Antonio Vargas. He's with us today from New York. His new memoir, just out today, is titled Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. And we have an excerpt of it at our website, onpointradio.org. Jose, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let me just start by asking you a simple question about the title of your book, the subtitle specifically, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. And on the jacket of the book, the word citizen is underlined. Why do you want that to be the subtitle?
Well, first of all, I kind of pray in the altar of James Baldwin. Notes of a Native Son was like the first kind of one of the first books that I read that just haunted me when I was in high school. And so that title is a nod to Baldwin. And thank you for asking about the underline of the word citizen. I cannot think of a more important word than the concept of citizen and citizenship and what it means to exist in this country, knowing that you have to live your life with as much dignity as possible, but knowing that you're surrounded by everybody else and that we have a responsibility to each other, that we're accountable to each other.
Mm. So civic responsibility you're talking
yes,
about.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm. Well, you know what? So let's explore that in terms of what it's meant in the context of your life. Tell us the story. Tell us a little bit about the beginnings of your American story. You were brought to the United States at the age of 12. How did that happen?
I woke up one day, one morning in the Philippines, and my suitcase was packed, and my mom sent me to the airport. She was at the airport with me. And she said I was going to America to live with her parents, my grandparents. I was 12, and I got to California in like 1993. And, you know, I mean, I didn't really know much about what America was supposed to be. And that this was, I think my introduction to American culture was like the O.J. Simpson trial. That was like the big kind of like, okay, what's happening here? And then, you know, in the book, I talk about this a little bit, like the notion of this black and white America and where there's this, you know, Asian looking guy with a Spanish name who's Filipino fit in that binary.
Mm-hmm.
I thought everything was fine. You know, my grandparents are both naturalized U.S. citizens. My grandma was a food server. My grandfather was a security guard. Then when I was 16, I think one of my best friends, Arvind Murthy, was tired of driving me around. But he was too polite to say anything. But he said, hey, you know, it might be a time to get a driver's permit. So I did. I didn't tell anybody that I was going to one afternoon go to the DMV with my green card and my ID from Mountain View High School. And I was listening. I'll never forget this. I was listening to Alanis Morissette and Boyz II Men and Walkman. Remember those? Walkmans. Yeah. Went to the DMV. Didn't think anything about it. Showed the woman my green card and my Mountain View High School ID. And the woman at the DMV looked at the green card, flipped it a couple of times, and she said this was fake. She said it was fake. And then she said, don't come back here again.
Hmm.
And, you know, the moment she said fake, in my head, I kept thinking, I'm not Mexican. Because even, you know, back then, this was in 97, you know, kind of in the middle of Proposition 187, right? Which in many ways is like the precursor for this Trump era that we're living through now.
Right. Just so folks know, that was the California state
that
proposition
California state.
That would deny state services to...
including public schools,
yeah,
right?
To including undocumented immigrants, school. Right, and their children, exactly.
But whenever the media, whenever the radio, whenever the newspapers, whenever, you know, anybody talked about it, it was always about Mexican people. And since my name is so Spanish, right, because of Spanish colonialism, I was thinking maybe this woman thought I was Mexican. But I didn't say anything to her. I just went home. My grandfather worked the graveyard shift, so he was always home in the afternoon. And I confronted him about it, and that's when I found out. That's when I found out kind of the beginning of the lies, like the lies that they had to tell, that they wanted me to tell, that the paper, that the green card is fake, that I was smuggled here. That they spent $4,500, which is a big amount of money for people who made, you know, my grandfather, I think $6 an hour was what he was making.
Jose,
so that was the beginning of all of that.
So I want to explore that particular moment in just a second. But first, there's an obvious question that I'm sure many people have on their minds right now. If your grandparents were naturalized citizens, what prevented them from using their citizenship to either help bring your mother over through family unification or even get you naturalized?
So that was part of the lie, right? Like they lied in the form and said that my mother was single, even though she was married, because they didn't like my dad. My dad abandoned my mom, when I was 3 years old. The only thing I know about my dad is I have his eyebrows. That's about it. And with me, you know, grandparents are not, it's not considered close enough of a relationship for grandparents to petition their grandchildren.
Mm.
So the lie was I come here, I work under the table. My grandfather's brother, David, had a job as a janitor at the flea market in San Jose. So the plan was I would work under the table as a janitor after high school, and then I would find a woman to marry who's a U.S. citizen, and then poof, it would get fixed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what my grandfather wanted to do. And around that time, because, you know, now that I'm realizing what they've done— I said to him, well, I'm not marrying a woman, I'm gay. So, as you can imagine, you know, in a Catholic household, that was a big problem.
Yeah.
That was
so
a big
like
problem.
Like lightning striking twice in your household.
You know, but again, in my head, and this is, you know, the naive 16-year-old in my head, I kept thinking, wait a second. So now I'm supposed to lie again? So you brought me here on a lie, and now I'm supposed to lie again so I can go marry a woman, mm-hmm. right? And so I thought, okay, well, in many ways, that was my own sense of declaring kind of an independence and saying, wait a second here, like, I don't want to go along with this. And, you know, what happened was, too, was about 2 months after this, I found out my English teacher, Mrs. Dewar, Kathy Dewar, said I asked too many annoying questions and I should do this thing called journalism, which I didn't know anything about. You know, no one in the family was a writer. You know, we're a family of carpenters and security guards and food servers. Like, no one wrote. No one was really, quote unquote, a professional in that way. So, but I figured that when you write something on the newspaper, you would get your name on it.
Yeah.
It would say by Jose Antonio Vargas. So again, my 16-year-old naive self, I thought to myself, why don't I just get my name on the piece of paper, and then that would be a way of saying I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
That was literally the only reason I became a journalist. And I, you know, the first story I wrote on the front page was a fire, and I got assigned to cover it because it was just right down the street from where I was living. And my grandmother saw the article on the front page of the weekly newspaper, and she screamed out loud. You know,
what
she's
are you
like,
doing?
What are you doing? You're supposed to be hiding.
But Jose, before we go too far into your career as a journalist and sort of the accomplishments and complexities that brought, I still want to explore with you this moment when you were told by your grandfather that the document that you had, that, you know, the papers that you had were fake and that you were... your status in America was as an undocumented immigrant. I mean, you write in the book that you were speechless, that you had all these questions, some of which were, can I tell my friends about this? Can I trust my family? Who can I trust? Could you even trust yourself? I mean, I want to explore this a little bit more because, the whole framework that you had for your life in the United States fell apart at that moment, did it not?
Not only did it fell apart, I mean, there was no... I didn't have any context, right? I mean, this is why the internet is this really miraculous thing, right? I mean, I wonder what would have happened if I had had Google. If I could, like, at least, like, type in, you know... Because back then, no one was using the term undocumented, right? It was just illegal this, illegal that, illegal that. And then this idea that the moment you tell somebody... I mean, I remember my friend Arvin, who's a dear friend. Actually, he's now, you know, living in Cambridge. I told him, and the moment I told him, he just had this, like, look of not just confusion, but this look of, like, how do I help him? How does he help me? And then I felt like whenever I told somebody, I was burdening somebody with that information, right? And so that's when I started thinking, oh, shoot, I probably shouldn't tell anybody else. Because if Arvin, who's, like, the smartest person I knew at that time, very smart guy, if he couldn't figure out how to help me, then, you know, who else do I tell this to? So I just didn't have any context at all. And the fact that my grandfather, you know, he had kind of concocted this reality that I had to live, and I had to figure out how to get out of that. And in many ways, you know, I'm not sure what would I have done if I hadn't come out gay as early as I did, right? Because if I, you know, I don't know if I could have held on to those two secrets at once. Like, I mean, that's the thing about secrets, right? They like eat you up. And then all of a sudden you kind of operate from this place where you're kind of not only in this metaphorical closet, but it becomes a physical closet in which your space becomes very, very limited. So I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't come out as gay as early as I did.
Yeah. When we come back, we'll talk about the fact that perhaps your story is extraordinary for several reasons, one of which is that you actually did have a lot of people around you who ended up being very helpful and influential in your life. We're speaking with Jose Antonio Vargas. His new book, his new memoir is Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. And we'd love to know what your question is for Jose. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Hi, I'm Daniel Alarcón, host of NPR's Spanish language podcast, Radio Ambulante. We tell engaging, one-of-a-kind stories that give you a more nuanced sense of Latin America and the U.S. Latino community today. From events that are changing the political landscape to intimate stories about everyday people. Listen to Radio Ambulante on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Jose Antonio Vargas. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author, and filmmaker. And he's author of the new memoir, Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. And it's his story, his memoir of his life as being an undocumented immigrant in the United States. He was brought here at the age of 12. Jose, so let me ask you a question. You write very eloquently in the book about all the things that you do in order to, you know, continue developing your life in the United States after you discovered as a teenager, that you're finally told as a teenager that you don't have immigration papers for this country. You talk about how you went about getting a driver's license from the state of Oregon. I mean, it's a really fascinating story that you tell, and I don't want to give it all away. But that's my lead up to asking what should be a simple question, which is you also write about how over time you spoke with many immigration attorneys about what you should do. And some of the times the advice you got is maybe you should go back to the Philippines, wait the 10 years and then reapply for citizenship or immigration to the United States. Why was that never a realistic option for you?
I waited really long, you know, like as I said, journalism became my sole identity. It was really the only thing that mattered was being a journalist. From 16 to 30, Why? Because the Oregon driver's license that you mentioned was valid for 8 years. It was valid from 2003 till 2011. So I had 8 years to figure out how I could earn this thing, right? This American thing. Because since I was a kid, since finding out that I was here illegally, the media, everybody says that people like me should earn this citizenship. Mm-hmm. So I thought, let me do everything I can to do that. And so then I've done that. I had, you know, I have a resume that I'm proud of. But then nothing was getting fixed, right? My license was about to expire. It was the only piece of ID I ever had, and I had at that time. I would not have had a career at the Washington Post without that Oregon driver's license.
Yeah.
By the way, now Oregon doesn't allow undocumented immigrants to drive. Oregon, the same year that Oregon passed a law to legalize marijuana, is the same year that they took away driver's licenses. So I didn't know what to do, and so I started talking to lawyers. I spoke to maybe about 30, all of whom said that I was in big trouble because not only have I lied, but I'd committed fraud. And even talking to you right now about openly saying that I committed fraud is not what lawyers want me to do.
Right. I mean, the fraud that you committed regarding the driver's license was that
driver's license, all the jobs I had at the Washington Post, at the San Francisco Chronicle, at the Huffington Post, at the New York, all of that. But here's the thing. If we're going to get anywhere here, we have to like actually tell the truth, right? So because I wanted to tell the truth, the lawyers were like, well, the moment you do that, we can't help you. Mm-hmm. Not even marriage would solve this because the fact that I admitted to breaking laws would mean that I can't just adjust my status through marriage. The only solution was either a pardon from the president, which at the time was President Obama, who was deporting about 400,000 immigrants a year, right? A private bill from Congress, which means that I would put myself in such a position where since I am so successful, blah, 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 go ahead and save me. I couldn't sit with that. The third thing would be immigration reform and, you know, the fact that it would grant us what immunity in some way, but we don't know what's going to happen with that. Or the fourth decision is to leave, right? One of the lawyers said to me, you know, you can be a writer anywhere, Mr. Vargas. You built a really successful career. And I sat with that for a while. I kept thinking, you know, if you don't want me here, yeah, let me just go leave and I can go live my life. I can go see my mom. Right? I can go see my sister. I can go see my brother. I can figure out where I come from because I don't really know what the Philippines is. You know,
yeah.
So I thought about that for a while. And then I realized that, you know, I am who I am because of America. This is where I became who I am.
But let me ask you, Jose, I mean, I just want to repeat this question. I hear you saying that, like, you had lived formative years in the United States. And yes, it helped define who you are. But, you know, you talk about in the book the toll that telling lie after lie takes on you and constructing this, you know, this almost alter ego to deal with the consequences of not being documented. And I suppose what I'm getting at is, well, in order to accept the truth and the consequences of that truth, there are many people who would say, and yes, you were brave to end the lie, but accept the truth. And that is there are certain immigration laws that you maybe not out of your own choice, but you ended up breaking. And so the way to deal with that is to leave and is to go wherever, Canada, the Philippines. You know, you talk about lots of possibilities in the book and move forward that way. And yet you obviously you chose not to. And as millions of people have.
But the other way to look at it is, why are the laws the way that they are?
Mm-hmm.
The other way to look at it is to ask, who constructs these laws? Why are they the way that they are? And, you know, in the book, you know, again, like I don't know where I would be if I hadn't read James Baldwin and Toni Morrison as early as I did, right? They made me, I mean, I think for me, you know, I ended up majoring in political science and African American studies in college because, you know, the history of African Americans in this country is a real challenge to the master narrative of American history. What is legal? What is acceptable? What is just? What does freedom really mean? Right? And then when I started reading about Native Americans and how too often we leave them out of the equation, like some people would say that I'm here and I'm flaunting my illegality, right? I would argue that I'm only showing Americans what American history is supposed to be about, which is challenging and questioning the very notion of who an American is and what constitutes that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the question for me.
Well, we're speaking with Jose Antonio Vargas. He's author of the new memoir, Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. Bill O'Reilly at one time called Jose probably the most famous, quote, illegal in America. What questions do you have for Jose Antonio Vargas about his experience as an undocumented immigrant? And now, you know, as of 2011, publicly his experience as an undocumented immigrant in the United States. And what way forward do you see with immigration? Jose, let me just get a quick call in here. Peter is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Peter.
Yes, I've heard this gentleman before, and I have some empathy. I understand, but I get kind of tired listening and the victimization. I mean, if you check off on his book, how many slots of victimization he's in? You know, there's people like me, and with full confession, I'm a fourth, fifth generation Irish out of Boston area, working class, who had go back to the Civil War and on. If my family members have fought in every damn war that this country's had going forward, for World War One, World War Two. I'm a Vietnam veteran. My younger sister is in Iraq, Afghanistan. Everybody plays their dues. And the question I have is this, back in the immigration law back in the 1840s, 1850s, they needed people to come over and populate the country, and they got the indentured Irish and Scotch to come over, cheaper than slaves, because it's much cheaper to have them come over, and they paid their dues. The turn of the century, 1900.
Hey, Peter, I'm just wondering if I might just jump in here. What's your question? I'm not clear about what your question is.
The question is, isn't a country have a right to have immigration laws? Is everybody who comes in, like this gentleman, and he also kind of minimizes he's a wealthy illegal immigrant, don't they have a right to say, listen, you've got to play by the laws?
Well, Peter, thank you so much for your call. Jose, I guess Peter, they're looking at, in a way, talking about what you were talking about earlier. He sees that the immigration laws do exist and the nation has the right to enforce them. So what's the problem there?
Well, the problem there was, you know, back in the 1840s and 50s, there were no laws. There were no green cards. There were no visas. Irish people showed up in this country after the potato famine because they needed a place to go. They crossed the border that was the Atlantic Ocean, and that's how they got here. And as for paying their dues, let's talk about that. Let's talk about the fact that we live in a country that could not exist without undocumented labor. Let's talk about the fact that we exploit undocumented labor in this country. Let's talk about the fact that we put a flag outside of the U.S.-Mexico border saying keep out, and then 10 yards in we say help wanted. Don't talk to me about breaking laws if we're not actually addressing all those American employers, right, whose businesses could not exist without us, right? Mm-hmm. And as for the wealthy part, you know, I am proud to say that I can afford to support my family. I am proud to say that I pay a lot of taxes. And whenever I write that check to the IRS, I say to myself, I love America. I love America. I love America. I'm a product of public schools. I love public libraries. I don't know where I would be without public libraries. And the fact of the matter is, you know, I think if you're a part of this country, you must contribute to it. But if you're going to turn around and look around your community and see who's contributing, are you going to tell me that it's not undocumented workers? Is that what you're trying to say?
You know, I don't know if that's what Peter was trying to say, but you know, in the many conversations which you've had, that we've had here on this program, that America has been having, I think a lot of people, that's not what they're saying. But what they're saying is they just believe in the system of laws that we do have now. You know,
your
point of the 19th century, well taken, but that, you know, there's, and in fact, it's many legal immigrants who, you know, you write in the book, it's some so supposedly liberal legal immigrants have been your fiercest critics.
Absolutely. But actually, let's take that one step further. So if we're going to apply the laws as it exists to undocumented people like me, what about applying that laws, again, to all the American employers who depend on us? What about applying that laws, right, all around? I mean, this is why I think legality as a construct here is not—it's not sufficient, because then we have to ask ourselves, what kind of country do we want to be? Do we want to be a country, for example, right now that locks up children in cages in South Texas and in detention centers across this country? How many more billions of dollars we want to spend to protect us from Mexico, when the reality is the fastest growing undocumented population are coming from Asia, Koreans, Indians, Filipinos like me? Mm-hmm. What are we really talking about? And I think it's really important, though, for us to look at history as a guide, but then to ask ourselves, what are we trying to build together, right? And I have to say to you, by the way, like I am, I happen to be gay. I happen to be undocumented. I happen to be Filipino. I refuse very early on in my life to be, quote unquote, a victim. I refuse to surrender to what these systems expect me to be. I think, led a life that's all about trying to figure out what can I do to transcend the circumstances that I didn't control.
Mm-hmm. Jose, let me ask you. I mean, in 2011, you decided to go public with your status, obviously to considerable risk then, and that risk hasn't diminished at all. Tell us, why did you want to do that?
I mean, I think all of us in some way, all of us carry some sort of privilege, whatever that may be. And the question becomes, what are you doing to risk your privilege? And, you know, at that point, in 2011, I thought to myself, I can't be the only person going through this. Meaning I thought that there's undocumented doctors, undocumented lawyers, other people that kind of beside, you know, in addition to the narrative that we know about undocumented farmers, undocumented construction workers, right? And as a gay man, what the coming out movement has done for gay, for LGBTQ people in this country to kind of reclaim their identity and to come out to let people in, to me, that was such a model in the way we should be thinking about not only undocumented immigration, because you can't really separate the undocumented population from the documented population, right? So I'm Filipino. I have like, what, 34 Filipino-American relatives in this country. I'm the only one who's here without documents, without legal documents. Everybody else is either naturalized or born here, right? So you can't separate these two populations from each other. So for me, it became a question of what I was willing to do. Now, I'd be lying to you if I didn't tell you that I didn't consider leaving, mm-hmm. right? I was thinking it might be easier for me because the other thing is I wasn't sure that I was ready for this public life, whatever that even supposed to mean, or what an activist is supposed to be or what an activist is supposed to do, you know? And even now, you know, I write about that in the book, right? Like there are some people in the immigrant rights movement who think that I'm not radical enough.
Right, yeah, they call you too privileged, opportunist, and elite.
I mean, I'll never forget that. You know, like there was this undocumented Mexican organizer, and he told me that I couldn't possibly represent undocumented people because I was too successful. And then he said, I mean, he didn't mean for me to hear it, but I heard him say, you're not even Mexican. And, you know, and he said that with such hurt, right? That I was angry at it when he first said it, because all I kept thinking about was, you know, I existed and I worked in a lot of newsrooms, like for example, like the Washington Post, where I had to keep justifying why I was even in the room, right? And then all of a sudden, I come out, I tell my story, and all of a sudden, I wasn't enough either for this other thing. So that's how I looked at it. And then when I thought about it even more, you know, even in writing about it in the book, how do I make sure that I'm giving him, you know, that I'm trying to understand where he's coming from, right? Given how anti-Mexican this country has gotten. You know, like that's the thing, by the way. I've been traveling all across this country the past 7 years. I completely underestimated, you know, how anti-Mexican this country is in terms of the fact that people use the term illegal and Mexican interchangeably. Mm-hmm. Interchangeably. And even us, you know, as I'm talking to you right now, the New York Times, the Washington Post, sometimes NPR still call people illegal. Right. When the reality is, you know, human beings can't be illegal. The moment we start thinking that, that's when we lock children up in cages. Mm. That's what happens.
So, I mean, Jose, you make this decision in 2011, in a sense, as you write in the book, to free yourself from the burden of the continuous lies, right? But I mean, we've just got a minute before we have to take a quick break here, but were there immediate consequences to that decision?
The hardest has been figuring out how to kind of, you know, work here, right? Like one of the lawyers said to me, okay, Mr. Vargas, how are you going to make a living? Right? So for a while there, I couldn't. So I had to figure out how can I legally but creatively stay in this country And then I figured out that I can actually be an entrepreneur. I can start a business and employ people, so long as I'm not being employed.
Uh-huh. Well, we'll explore much more of Jose Antonio Vargas's story in his new memoir, Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. Jose is speaking to us today from New York. And by the way, we have a link to an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Hi, this is Peter Sagal. For 20 years, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me has been making fun of the news with comedians and celebrity guests. We got silly limericks. We got terrible impressions. If you think the news is a joke, wait till you hear our show. New podcast episodes are available every Saturday.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're speaking this hour with Jose Antonio Vargas. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author, and filmmaker. He's founder and CEO of Define American, a nonprofit media and culture organization that focuses on issues of immigration, identity, and citizenship. Jose Antonio Vargas is himself an undocumented immigrant, and he writes about his story in his new memoir, Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. Now, in 2011, as we were talking about before the break, Jose did decide to write publicly about his status, and it was the first time he wrote about his story. He became one of the most high-profile undocumented immigrants in the country after that, and by the time November of 2014 rolled around, Jose appeared on Fox News to talk with Bill O'Reilly about an immigration plan that had just been unveiled by President Obama.
It is a compassionate move.
Yes.
But it may not be a just move. Because you and the other people here illegally don't deserve to be here. That's harsh. It's harsh.
You
don't have an entitlement to be here.
Oh.
Not through any fault of your own.
That's Jose Antonio Vargas appearing on Bill O'Reilly's show in November 2014. Jose, can you tell us about that moment?
He was in New York and I was in D.C., so I couldn't see him, you know, in person. But I was, to be perfectly honest, I was rattled. I didn't quite know how to respond to that, this idea that I don't deserve to be here. And it wasn't until I got off the chair, it was a live show. It wasn't until I got off the chair that I started thinking to myself, you know, wait a second, like, you know, what did Bill O'Reilly do to deserve to be here? Mm-hmm. And actually that moment, that was one of the moments in the past 7 years that kind of led me to even the title of the book, right? Like I was very deliberate in using the word citizen in the title of the book because I think it actually puts into question, right? What constitutes citizenship? You know, right. I mean, legally, of course, it's you're born here, right?
And you're naturalized.
So what have you done to be born here? The accident of birth, congratulations, that's wonderful. But is that how the country got to be so great? Because people were just accidentally born in this country? Like, what are we fighting for? And again, I think about, you know, now in the headlines, right? You can't – every day feels like some sort of an apocalypse for immigrants in this country. And I'm amazed that undocumented people get up every day all around this country, drive their kids to work, drive their kids to school, go to work, even in states we're not supposed to be even driving, right? Massachusetts, for example, doesn't allow undocumented people to drive. New York does not allow. Texas, 1.8 million undocumented people in the state of Texas. I'm sorry, is there a subway system I don't know about in Texas? Like, how are people getting around if you don't have a license? But isn't it amazing that we still get up every day and go to school, you know, send the kids, make sure that we're taking care of our families this conditions.
But let me just jump in here, because you asked a very interesting question, possibly the most important question about, you know, what are we fighting for here when we're fighting over this question of citizenship and belonging and deserving? I mean, President Trump has given an answer to that question. His answer is we're fighting for the identity of the country. I mean, he has said repeatedly, if you don't have a border, you don't have a country. I mean, I think, and many people agree with him, that is what they are fighting for.
I would also agree that, by the way, let me agree with this. We are absolutely fighting for the soul of this country. We are absolutely right now fighting in every community, in every state, in every municipality, how a community decides who's welcome, right? Mm-hmm. Absolutely, that is happening. As for the borders, you know, look, of course, let me just be very, very perfectly clear about this. Of course, a country has a right to determine who comes and who doesn't. Of course, a country has a right to say, these are our borders. But at the same time, a country has to figure out why people are coming here to begin with. I mean, even the whole concept of this question of trying to figure out the root causes of migration and why people come, to me, is one of the most kind of under-explained. Like, we don't talk about that. Like, what has the impact of NAFTA been, you know, to the Mexican economy? Why is it that Mexicans felt the need to cross whatever border they had to cross just so they can feed their kids? Mm-hmm. When in the book, I wrote about being detained in McAllen, you know, for 8 hours.
In 2014, right?
In 2014, during the Obama administration. Back then, it wasn't as much of an outcry as it's been during the Trump administration, right? And I'll never forget, like, you know, sitting in that cell with those boys. They separated us by genders. I was with the boys. And all I kept thinking about was the countries they come from, El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, right? And how violent some of those countries have gotten. And I kept thinking about the drug war, right, that the U.S. has started and continues to fund. And I think about kind of what the impact of economic and foreign policies have been to those countries. And, you know, I kept thinking back to the shoes that they were wearing. You know, a lot of the boys had Nikes and Reeboks and Adidas knockoffs. I mean, I don't know. But it was so interesting to see, like, the American brands, right, that come to their countries, that come to our countries, like the Philippines, for example. And it's fascinating that corporations and brands can come to our countries, right? And then the question of who gets to come here.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jose, we've got a lot of callers who want to join us. So let me let them talk to you for a moment. Andre is calling from Atlanta, Georgia. You're on the air, Andre.
Hey, how are you guys doing? Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. We're here with you, Andre. Go ahead.
Okay. Hey, first, I just want to say thanks, Jose. I'm going to DM you later if you ever need someone to talk when you're frustrated or something, and I understand what you're going through most of the time. I think what Jose is trying to get at is that a lot of times it's much easier for us to point fingers to what is the issue or what is causing problems towards us, but we don't really look at the actual cause. I've been here for 16 years. I'm turning 27 next month. And if DACA goes away within the next year and a half, I'm back to being an undocumented immigrant. Mm. And the reason that we come here is because we're looking for a better life. You know, like the whole country, the whole foundation of the United States was on people coming here looking for a better life. If you want to go back to, like, oh, this is the only United States where nobody's, like, everybody's from here, then we got to go back to the natives. And let's not even start talking about that. But as far as, like, I've been here for 17 years, and we haven't even had, like, revolutionary immigration policy change or anything. We're all just basically pointing fingers at the people that are here, but we're not trying to change anything.
Yeah. Well, Andre, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Lisa, who's calling from Saratoga, New York. You're on the air, Lisa.
Hi, thank you. Jose, this conversation resonates with me immensely on a personal level and then just as a professional interest as well. I am married to an undocumented Mexican. He came here, like your previous caller, about 18 years ago to support his family. And we have been through, you know, all of the hoops you mentioned. We've had four separate attorneys. who all give us the same advice, which is to do nothing, to just stay under the radar and to try and live as quietly and not, you know, interact in a way where we will be found out, so to speak. But my question for you is really about, you know, you mentioned the devaluing of this population, the fortitude to just go on, to endure these long separations, to get up every day and go to work. For me, and I also have an African studies degree, and I think that informs my perspective, but the juxtaposition, which I think has been sort of enhanced since Trump came into office, but we have all of these personal friends, and most know his status. They are, you know, so affectionate and loving toward him and think the world of him and put him on this pedestal as a great worker, a great person.
Lisa, forgive my interruption. I'm so sorry to interrupt. Forgive me, but I'm just I'm conscious of the time here, and I want to give Jose a chance to respond to him. Just wondering what your question is for him.
Here it is. So for me, it's difficult that we never get to have a conversation or never gets to come into the national conversation about the emotional toll, like the devaluing kind of
the emotional toll
on these people.
Lisa, I hear you, and your phone's just dropping out on us there. Jose, go ahead and respond to her.
And that's really actually what the book is about.
Yeah.
Originally, I wanted to write about policy. I wanted to write a manifesto about global migration. You know, the book is dedicated to 253 million migrants in the world and to my mother. And I wanted to understand my own psychology. I wanted to understand, like, what the cost has been of all the lying and the passing and all the hiding. You know, I didn't realize that I had spent 14 years of my life from 16 to the age of 30 hiding from the government. And I didn't realize that that actually meant that I was actually hiding from myself, from the relationship I was having with people, right? Like, it was really hard for me, and it's still really hard for me to kind of, like, let people into my space because I'm so used to just kind of like, okay, this is my thing, and I don't have to tell you anything. I don't have to answer things about why I'm here. I came to an industry that I ask the questions. I don't answer them. So this book is an answer to that. It's trying to understand kind of what the mental – kind of mental health crisis that we're all living through. And that was my goal in really writing the book, was to get people to understand what the toll is of this.
Yeah.
Coming from a 37-year-old man.
You must walk around wondering every day if today is the day you're going to get deported.
You know, yes. You know, but I've been ready for that. I've been ready for that, you know, 7 years ago when I started doing this work. You know, I'm aware of what the consequences are. So the question for me now, knowing that, is how do I face myself and how do I live the fullest life that I can possibly live? Like, what does that look like to me? Right? And, you know, in this book, I'm about to go to this book tour all across the country. And I know I'm preparing myself for all the stories that I'm going to hear and that at Define America and that we're going to collect. The organization that I started is like the largest kind of collection of undocumented stories online. So we're going to collect these stories, right? And we're going to try to figure out how we use stories not just to correct and to intervene in the narrative, but to liberate people. So in a way, as I write in the book, you know, this book is the closest thing I have to feeling like I'm free in a country in which I'm not.
Jose, I just want to take one more call here, if I can. Let's go to Joey, who's calling from Chesapeake, Virginia. You're on the air, Joey.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I actually went to high school with Jose. He was a couple classes above me, but I definitely remember him. And he was talking earlier about basically the laws and how, why they are the way they are. My real question is just, what is the plan to change them? Like, do you have any idea of what you want to do to go forward to correct this whole situation from a legal standpoint?
Joey, thanks for your call. Jose, go ahead.
And go Spartans. That's the Mountain View High School mascot. We can't really talk about changing the laws until we actually know what the problem is. And I would argue that we do not know what the problem is. When Reagan tried to pass and did pass some sort of, you know, amnesty back in the 80s, the problem there was no consequences for employers, right? So that's why we've never able even you know, that's been, what, 30 years now since we've had any sort of meaningful reform. I think it's going to require the kind of truth-telling that we haven't been able to have in such a partisan, toxic environment. And then we have to figure out, what do we want to do with 11 million people? By the way, it's way more than 11 million people. If I just counted all the white undocumented people that I meet at Starbucks who come out to me at Starbucks and say, hey, you know, whenever they talk about this issue, I feel really guilty that they're not thinking about me because I'm German or French or British, right? It's way more than 11 million people. We have to figure out how many people in this country do not have legal status. And then we have to ask ourselves, right, what do we want to do with them? If you told me, for example, that you want me to wait 15 years to stand in a line that doesn't exist yet, until I become a U.S. citizen, okay, 15 years. I got to tell you, though, man, like, I really want to vote. I really want to participate more fully in this country. And I don't know if a piece of paper telling me I'm a citizen, I don't know if that's all I need. As far as I'm concerned, you know, I actually am an American. I'm just waiting for my own country to recognize it.
Jose, it's been 25 years since you've seen your mother. Is that right?
Yeah, 25 years last month.
I mean, you end the book with a conversation that you have with her about where your home is now.
I did that because I think it's only fair that she had the last say in the book, right? And to know that my life doesn't make sense without her. This was the choice that she made and the choice that I had to live with, you know, coming here. And so I ended the book because I wanted her to make sure that, you know, she was the first. When I got the first physical copy of the book, I mailed it to her. I wanted her to be the first person to have it. And so that's why I did that. And I also did that because I think this whole question of what's home, right? Like, what constitutes a home? Who defines home for us? Who makes us feel at home? You know, it's interesting. I haven't had my mom since I was 12, but I have so many mothers. I have a Jewish mom, I have a Mexican mom, I have a lot of black moms, I have a lot of white moms. Like, I've just collected moms all over the country. And that's my way, too, of kind of honoring the fact that the reason why I'm here, a big reason why I'm here, is because so many people have welcomed me here.
And I mean, we've just got about 30 seconds to go, and I'm still just trying to understand the mental space that you're in right now, because as you write in the book, your walls are not walls. Your walls are oceans, because you can't, I mean, you could leave, but then you couldn't come back. So again, I'm sorry to ask you this in 30 seconds, but how do you navigate that every day?
Toni Morrison said, "Freedom is in my mind." Oh man, I say that to myself every day, like a prayer.
Well, Jose Antonio Vargas, his new memoir is Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. We've got an excerpt of it at our website, onpointradio.org. Jose, thank you so much for joining us today and for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, keep your comments coming at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook. We're at On Point Radio. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.